President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden met on stage last night in Cleveland for the first of three debates. We have morning after analysis with your insights on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead of the debate, the Biden campaign released the Democratic nominee's 2019 tax returns and his running mate's Kamala Harris's returns, keeping the focus on the New York Times' investigation published this week that found President Trump has paid little or no federal income tax for years. Did you watch last night's debate? Who do you think won? What statements or messages stood out to you? We're at 800-642-1234. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, NPR's political editor wrote this morning, this was maybe the worst presidential debate in American history. What did you make of it?
I completely agree. You know, the display, just the contention between the candidates was actually really, really shameful. And in particular, you know, President Trump acted like an aggressor. And I know that some people, you know, like that, that they think that he's speaking truth to power, but he is the power. And so I think to a lot of people, he just looked like he was bullying Joe Biden.
And it was bitter and caustic from the get-go. At one point, Vice President Biden told former Vice President Biden told the president to shut up. Let's have a listen.
The radical question, left.
Will you shut up,
your,
man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
who's
is
on your
so
list?
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
Unprecedented.
What do you make of the hostility on display between both candidates?
Well, one, I think to some level we expected that. If we go back to 2016 and think about how President Trump interacted with first the Republican field and then with Hillary Clinton, he's always the aggressor. And, you know, we know that sort of in his personal and business life, he likes to counterpunch in terms of an argument. And so we knew he wasn't going to back down from an argument in this particular time and that he was going to be particularly aggressive with Vice President Biden because the hope was to get him to make a misstep, to perhaps lose his train of thought so that he could confirm the things that he's been saying for the last couple of weeks about not just him being low energy, but perhaps him having dementia. And so Joe Biden succeeded in not necessarily sort of, you know, proving, you know, and proving that he can, you know, withstand a debate and that he held his own. But we didn't learn much from the debate because of all the shouting going back and forth.
Well, let's take a call now. Chris is joining us from Luck this morning. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning. What did you think?
I think that the format was a disaster. In other words, I think that if we reflect back on debates decades ago, maybe in the 70s, the candidates sat separately in chairs and had to approach the microphone individually to answer questions. And that gave opportunities for them to answer questions about the banter and all the negativity.
Without being stepped on by their opponent. Andra, what did you make of the format?
I mean, this is a format that has been used before. You know, I agree with the caller that perhaps future debates may consider not necessarily having a debate back and forth between the two candidates, but direct questions towards the individual ones. But that was what Chris Wallace was trying to do. And so as long as long as you can't cut a mic off on somebody, I would expect that Donald Trump is going to try to talk over people because that's how he thinks he wins debates.
We're talking with Andra Gillespie, who is an associate professor of political science at Emory University, and she's unpacking last night's presidential debate, the first of three, with your insights at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Matt from Nisida. Hi, Matt. What did you think?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I think the debate is telling of the state of discourse, political discourse in the United States right now. I personally blame, partially the two-party system for limiting us to two choices. I would have loved, for example, to see Jo Jorgensen debate. I think she would have had a lot of insight and probably would not have devolved to what it was last night, which really was shameful.
Matt, thank you for your comments there. And Andra, this is the state of discourse in our country, Matt's saying.
I agree that it's the state of discourse. I'm not sure that having third-party candidates on the stage would have changed anything. If you recall, Donald Trump's first debate was in the summer of 2015. He did the exact same thing. I think he has just gotten better at it and is used to having a platform as president to be able to say mean things to people. So I think that regardless of the number of candidates on the stage, it was likely to have devolved into chaos because Donald Trump doesn't follow rules and conventions, right? And so some people view that as refreshing, but it was also very chaotic and very mean last night.
I want to look specifically at how they approached conversation about the current pandemic. Biden was on the attack and said the president's handling of the pandemic has especially hurt African Americans.
One in 1,000 African Americans has been killed because of the coronavirus. And if he doesn't do something quickly, by the end of the year, one in 500 will have been killed. One in 500 African Americans. This man is the savior of African Americans. This man cares at all.
So the vice president, they're repeatedly criticizing the president's handling of the pandemic and specifically people of color. Did these attacks seem effective?
To the extent that he was allowed to make them without talking over, without getting talked over by Donald Trump, I would say that they were somewhat effective. I think the biggest tell on race last night wasn't sort of his framing the pandemic in terms of the disproportionate impact on people of color. You know, with respect to the pandemic, I think it was pointing out that 200,000 people have died. I think it was, President Trump contradicting his task force members, the epidemiologists who have, been working on the front lines of this. But getting back to the race question, I think probably the most important takeaway from yesterday evening was his refusal to, unequivocally denounce white supremacists and to basically tell them to stand by. Heard that, and they're making their judgments accordingly.
Let's take a listen to that moment.
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. Do you want to call him? What do you want to call him? Give me a name.
White supremacists and white
supremacists.
Proud supremacists and right
proud boys. Stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a
FBI director.
This is a left-wing problem.
So why do you think the president is reluctant to denounce white supremacy groups there?
Well, I mean, President Trump has appealed to the racial resentments of some white people in order to garner their support. So because he has not been willing to repudiate white supremacists in the past if they've endorsed him, I think is something that's really telling, right? And so these are groups who, have been public in their endorsements and their support for President Trump, and he views them as a vital base, especially for a president who has, never garnered the approval or acceptance of the majority of voters in the country. So he is, taking the calculated risk that if he can drive up turnout amongst this aggrieved class of voters, that given their dispersion in smaller states in the United States, he can win the Electoral College. So I don't, I'm not going to speculate here whether or not he actually personally holds these views or not, but he has certainly made consistent appeals to these groups, despite anything that you could say that he's done that's benefited African-American communities. And for those instances where he has instituted a policy that has helped African-American communities or not hurt them, we can cite many other sort of actions that he has taken that suggest that he also, either is indifferent or outright hostile to the interests of African-Americans.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie is our guide to last night's presidential debate. Did you take it in? What did you think? Were there issues you wanted to address that the moderator, Fox News anchor Chris Wallace, didn't bring up? Do you think this debate will make a difference in the election? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Andra Gillespie here on the Ideas Network. We're getting morning after analysis on last night's presidential debate here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Fox News host Chris Wallace moderated, not an easy task, as we saw as the president refused to abide by the debate rules and repeatedly interrupted. Were you fact-checking? Where did you hear the candidates exploit the truth or be right on the money? Political analyst Andra Gillespie of Emory University is our guide, and we're fielding your insights as well, beginning with Mark here, who's joining us from Wisconsin Dells. Mark, what did you think?
What I think is that Chris Wallace needs to be fired, and we need to get a moderator that can maintain control. If a moderator cannot maintain control, he needs to shut down the debate immediately and send the children home. That's what I think. Bye.
Andra, what did you make of the work of the moderator and Chris Wallace?
I have to admit, I was somewhat surprised. Chris Wallace, of the four moderators selected, is the experienced moderator, particularly for the three presidential debate moderators. And so, you know, I would have expected that his would have been the debate moderation that would have been the most controlled.
And he said beforehand he wanted to be invisible.
Yes. I mean, you know, that was, you know, why we don't expect moderators to fact check and to do other things. I think that he had a very thankless task. And I have not had to moderate debates before, but I've certainly had to moderate more than my share of panels. When a panelist wants to do what they want to do, it's actually really hard to do that. And it seems easy to think that you could shut something down. It's actually a lot harder than it looks. So in some ways, I'm a little sympathetic to Chris Wallace. But I also think that that got out of control. And I think the thing that I worry about for future debates is whether or not those are going to get out of control in the hands of less experienced moderators.
Let's bring in John now in Madison. Hi, John. What are your thoughts?
I wanted to know if there was a way that moderators could turn off microphones when it's not the candidate's turn to speak. I grasp that it's the president of the United States and people, like, really want to hear him speak for some reason. But I really think that if you can't abide by the debate rules, it's impossible to have a reasonable debate. Also, how come moderators can't fact check?
John, thanks. Andra, can you tackle that first of off with can moderators turn off a mic?
You'd have to check with the presidential, with the Commission on Presidential Debates for that. I don't know if there's anything in the agreed upon rules that would prevent that from happening. I think probably there's going to be a revisiting of the standards, and you know, people were speculating last night on Twitter. I don't know sort of what this is worth about whether or not the other scheduled debates will go forward, given what happened last night. So I expect that they're going to try to do something to moderate what's going on. Both campaigns are going to have to agree to any changes, if there are to be any changes going forward. And I think that there's an open question about, even if they do agree, whether or not President Trump is actually going to abide by the rules when he gets into the room.
And that next debate is October 15th, set to be moderated by Steve Scully of C-SPAN.
Yeah, and I think to the other question about whether or not a moderator should fact check, it did happen a few years ago when Candy Crowley of CNN actually did fact check in real time, and she was highly criticized for it. It's, you know, most people think that this is supposed to be a format where the candidates are allowed to speak for themselves and to present their own vision, and for a moderator to intervene and especially to single one of the candidates out and call them a liar is something that might look like it is introducing a certain level of bias. I understand, you know, that President Trump, you know, it has been much more likely than other presidents to be caught in lies, but that's just what makes everything extraordinary. We have been used to following norms in terms of how campaigns run, our candidates run their campaigns, and then also how candidates behave and then what they do once they're elected president. And Donald Trump has completely thrown out the rule book. And so I think we're at a reckoning point where we ask ourselves whether or not that destruction, if we think about it, is actually helpful and constructive, or whether or not it's just chaotic.
I want to listen to one point here. Last night, Fox News' Chris Wallace, as we've been talking about, scolding the president for continually interrupting.
Mr. President, your campaign agreed to both sides would get 2-minute answers uninterrupted. Well, your side agreed to it, and why don't you observe what your campaign agreed to as a ground rule, okay, sir?
And so ground rules here thrown out the window, as we've been talking about. Andra, have ground rules been an important piece in the past in presidential debates?
I mean, you know, we have seen plenty of debates where we've watched, you know, candidates kind of flagrantly sort of not abide by the rules. But then there's not abiding by the rules, and then there is setting them on fire. And I think what we saw last night was completely setting them on fire. And that was a difference. And I think that that was part of the sort of frustration that got Chris Wallace to the point where he had to openly check them. And it's interesting that he appealed to the rules that you have previously agreed to try to sort of bring things back in line. I don't think it helped much, but I appreciated Chris Wallace's effort, and I think it shows how difficult that is. You know, it's one thing to consistently go over your time limit, which is what candidates do all the time, but it's another thing to just, you know, completely try to talk over people and not actually try to let your opponent get a word in edgewise and then continue to do it even when you get called on it.
We're talking with Andra Gillespie, who's an associate professor of political science at Emory University. She's our guide to last night's debate in Cleveland, with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Daryl, who's joining us from Menominee Falls. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to express my view about Donald Trump's behavior last night and during the debates, and it was just another fine example of the disrespect and lack of dignity that Donald Trump has and has always had since he entered office. He has no regard for rules, has no regard for anybody's right to speak. And it's really a shame that people have to make exceptions for a man that holds the office of the President of the United States, who acts like a five-year-old in front of the whole United States during a debate, because he's got to have.
Daryl, I want to ask you a quick question here. Would you watch future debates here? This is first of three. Would you watch the subsequent?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Andra. Andra, do you think this particular debate will move the needle at all on polling or how Americans feel at the ballot box?
And a short answer, no. I think most people came into this debate knowing who they were going to vote for that small sliver of truly undecided voters. This could help them decide who they're going to vote for and if they're going to vote at all. But I think for the most part, most people kind of came in knowing who they supported, and I don't think they changed their minds based on what they saw. I want to go back. I find it interesting that the previous caller mentioned that President Trump behaved like a five-year-old. My seven-year-old niece apparently was watching, and I got a text from my brother, and she asked, do they know that children could be watching this? Mm. And I just, out of the mouths of babes, I couldn't have said it better.
President Trump attacked mail-in voting during the debate, falsely claiming that ballots are being thrown out en masse and tampered with.
They're being sold. They're being dumped in rivers. This is a horrible thing for our country.
There is no.
This is not.
There is no.
This is not going to end well.
There is
okay.
No.
This is not
that.
Going
Vice
to
President
end
Biden.
Well.
So, what effect do you think these attacks on the election process might have on the results, or whether people trust the results?
Well, I mean, I think that what he is saying is muddying the waters and could cause people to, you know, to cause people to delegitimize the election results when they happen. I think it is important to point out that he is hyperbolizing the problems with elections. Yes, somebody threw out 9 ballots last week. We, you know, hope this election isn't going to come down to a margin of 7 votes. And so while I would never, you know, sort of justify that type of behavior, which looks like it was more of a clerical mistake than any type of malicious attempt to try to sway the vote. And we have to be vigilant. And the fact that we know about that suggests that election officials are doing their job. You know, the idea of him suggesting that, you know, there's going to be massive voter fraud because of absentee ballots is something that's problematic. It could be shaping voter behavior. One, in terms of depressing voter turnout because it could demobilize people, but it's also changing voter behavior in terms of people who are listening to him, perhaps being more likely to go vote in person. So long as they do it safely, that's okay, but, like, the reason why everybody is voting by mail is because, given the pandemic, not everybody should be standing online. People have gotten sick, including in your own state, by standing in line to vote. So, it's really problematic. I think he's also doing this in part because of the projections that Democrats are going to be most likely to vote by mail. So he could win on the machine count on election night and then watch his lead go away as absentee ballot votes coming in. But the whole idea that it's going to take months to run the election, there is a point where the Electoral College has to meet and a vote would have to be certified. So, yeah, I mean, this, you know, it's probably going to take longer than election night. But that's because people are actually doing their level best to count things accurately. And they're trying to do so in a way that doesn't look like they're trying to influence election results, which is why we don't count absentee ballots as they come in, because you just can't trust somebody to start counting a couple of days or weeks before the election and not tell people so-and-so is ahead or so-and-so is behind, and behave accordingly. So this is being done out of a sense of fairness and out of a sense of trying to make sure that everything is done correctly.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta. Coming up, we talk with a candidate who wasn't invited to last night's debate. We talk with Don Blankenship. That's after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're meeting a third-party presidential candidate here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden, step aside for a moment. There are nine other candidates who have qualified to appear on five or more presidential race ballots. That is Ballotpedia keeping score. There are five parties on the ballot here in Wisconsin. We have extended invitations to all of them. What do you want to know about the Constitution Party? What are your thoughts on third-party candidates? Do you vote for them? We're at 800-642-1234. Don Blankenship is running for president under the Constitution Party. He is former CEO of the coal company Massey Energy. In 2010, he was at the center of a deadly mine explosion that killed 29 men, and he spent a year in prison. He's on the ballot in 21 states, including Wisconsin. Don, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, Kate. I appreciate you having me on.
Why are you running for president?
Well, I think I know more firsthand what's wrong in the country and what needs to be done to fix it than anyone else could possibly know, because I was, as I say often, born in a poor house and made it all the way to the dinner table at the White House, and then they put me in the big house. So I know a lot more than anyone else could possibly know about how flawed the system is.
When you say our system is flawed, things need to be fixed, can you be specific? What are you talking about?
Well, there I was referring to the criminal justice system. You know, it's obvious that the judges and the establishment, if you will, knows what it takes to have a fair trial. They have laws that they call Brady or Giglio or Jinx that require the government and the FBI to turn over evidence that they have against accused Americans. But when they don't, nothing happens. The judges are appointed for life, and therefore they don't care how they rule or don't have to worry about how they rule. But the problem is bigger than criminal justice. It's, you know, it's everywhere. It's the fact that we have so much corruption in government, the fact that we have made ourselves dependent on dictatorships like China, the fact that we waste so much money that we will never get out of debt. So there's so many problems that my experiences will help me solve that I think that I would make a great president.
So you're running as part of the Constitution Party. And for those of us who don't know about it, what does this party represent?
Well, the name itself pretty well tells the story. You know, the Constitution Party members believe that it was the Constitution that made America great to begin with, and that we have to return to the Constitution. The Constitution says, for example, that all men are created equal. It doesn't say that the government should advantage one group of people over another.
What about women?
Well, women are people, so they should have equal rights, but we shouldn't have laws that favor gender or race one over the other, because that's what causes inequality, not equality.
In 2018, you called yourself Trumpier than Trump. What was that about? Is that true?
Yes. When I say that Trump believes that we should have tariffs on imports, I believe that we should have tariffs almost on all imports, and that we should rank countries as far as their environmental stewardship, as far as their treatment of human beings and so forth, and that we should put tariffs on countries that are not being good worldwide citizens rather than just when they begin to have nuclear proliferation, and that tariffs is the answer to the budget and also the answer to creating jobs in America. I believe that illegal immigration is illegal because it starts with the word illegal. So many of the policies that Trump advocates, I believe in. I'm a totally different personality and a lot more calm and I hope a lot more sensical than President Trump is. But actually, he has policies that will help return America to being the country that it once was.
You mentioned immigration. What would be your approach to immigration policies? What would you change? Would you build a wall?
I think that whether you build a wall or use electronics or whatever, that you have to control your borders. Well, I think 9/11 proved that, and I think that the number of illegals that are in the country that are committing violent acts and so forth proved that. I think that any company or country that doesn't select the people that are joining the company or country is not going to be as good as it could otherwise be. But I don't believe that you can deport 7 million people, that you can deport dreamers who were children that were brought here, you know, through no effort on their own, and they have really no place to be deported to. So I'm sort of in the middle on some of those issues. I believe in solutions rather than arguments, and I think that there is a solution to the illegal immigration problem that would benefit the country, and the parties, the two major parties, all they do is argue about it. They don't intend to fix it.
How do you feel about family separations that are occurring, sending children back to their country of origin?
Well, I think family separations are ridiculous because family is what's key to, you know, to having quality life and to not turning to crime and drugs and all that sort of thing. And but I also believe that, you know, if we stop people from entering the country, it would be a tremendous benefit to the American worker. I also believe that the lower income earners, many members of the Democratic Party, have been misled in that because they're the ones that suffer the most from illegal immigration.
We're talking with former coal executive Don Blankenship, who is running for president under the U.S. Constitution Party. We're exploring third-party candidates, extending invitations to them here on The Morning Show. What do you want to ask Don Blankenship about his platform? Do you vote for third-party candidates? Join in with your questions, your background, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Don, a third-party candidate hasn't won the White House since the 18th century. Why bother running?
Actually been since the 19th century, but yes, 170 years we've elected either a Democrat or a Republican, so hopefully over the next few years we can begin to convince people that they're wasting their vote when they vote for one or the other, because basically all it is drama. I think people saw last night in the debate that neither of those two candidates are going to help America at the end of the day because they're combative and divisive and they're more focused on themselves than they are the problems of the country. So at some point in time, Americans will turn to a third-party choice, and we have to be ready when they do.
What was your top-line takeaways from the debate last night?
Well, the lack of maturity. I think the Saturday Night Live will have to edit the debate very much to make it pretty funny. It's just ridiculous how they interrupt each other and won't allow one another to express their thoughts, and they don't have any substantive or some meaningful answers to the questions. I also didn't think Chris Wallace did a very good job because he prefaced a lot of his questions with alternative facts, and it was just a terrible debate.
Let's look at the pandemic. One of the big issues here is the fact that millions of people are getting sick, over 200,000 deaths, still spreading. As president, how would you address the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, I think we can look back in the 1920s in America and see one of the things that should have been done. You have to quarantine people like we did in 1925 when we had 600,000 cases of tuberculosis. You know, the idea that people that are asymptomatic spread or don't spread the virus is debatable, but the idea that people with symptoms spread the virus is obvious. So if you have symptoms and of the virus, you should have been quarantined or should have quarantined yourself immediately. But, you know, we stopped Chinese and Europeans from coming into the country.
Would you take actions to close down businesses, close down the economy?
No, I think based on the best information that I've seen, is people over 55, over 60 years old that are actually susceptible to death for the most part. I would have favored something where we went to the extreme to protect nursing homes, to protect people with other conditions, to protect people plus 55 or plus 60. But to shut down the entire economy and so forth probably caused more deaths through suicide and other issues than it saved. So it was a bad choice both for the economy and for dealing with the virus.
So you're saying people committing suicide because they are jobless? Is that what you're connecting to there?
Yes, I think that's one of the reasons alcohol sales were out of sight. And, you know, I haven't seen numbers that I can rely on, but it looks to me like we've actually had fewer deaths, you know, when you look at the entire picture than we have in normal years. And as you know or may know, the Center for Disease Control came out and said that only 9,000 of the, at that time, 180,000 deaths were solely related to COVID-19. And that some huge percentage were plus 60, and some huge percentage had as many as six or seven other ailments already. And so the virus itself wasn't responsible for nearly as many deaths.
Do you believe in the work of the CDC, the scientists of the CDC? Would you support this agency as president?
I think I support the CDC. I think having the Center for Disease Control is fundamental, but I don't know that I agree with everything they say or do, and it would depend on specific questions. But we need a Center for Disease Control, but we also need facts. I mean, it's clear that the facts about COVID-19 that are, or what has been represented to the public as facts are not facts.
What in particular are not facts?
Well, first of all, you can fundamentally believe that when you incentivize hospitals and others to classify a death as a COVID-19 death and you pay them to do that, that you're going to get more reported COVID-19 deaths and cases than there actually are. But more importantly, the CDC itself says that, as I said, only about 9,000 of 180,000 or so had died solely of COVID-19. And even there, a high percentage of them were in nursing homes and elderly. So the failure to properly measure the virus and what was actually going on led to bad policy, like was it Cuomo in New York that moved people from hospitals to nursing homes, where the nursing homes didn't even have the same protections that the hospital had. So that type of nonsensical behavior is what caused a lot of the deaths.
Don Blankenship, running for president as part of the Constitution Party. We'll be back with him in a minute. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Constitution Party presidential candidate Don Blankenship. We're exploring his platform and the role of third-party candidates. 34 days before the presidential election. There are five parties on the ballot in Wisconsin, and we've extended invitations to all of them. In Wisconsin, the Constitution Party got just north of 12,000 votes in 2016, 0.4% of the vote for president. Let's take a call now. Dave is joining us from Green Bay. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. I would like to jump back to something that your guest just spoke about, tariffs. Tariffs are effectively a tax on the people that put the tariff on. So originally, historically, America paid most of its government bills by charging tariffs, and that was effectively a tax on the American people. Do you understand that purpose when you are in favor of tariffs, sir?
Yes, I understand that the tariff shows up in the cost of the product, but I also understand that when you make the product, you get to tax it several steps along the way. You know, the commodity that's mined, whether it's iron or coal or whatever, or some other mineral, you get to tax that. You tax the wages when people are turning that into a product, and that creates jobs. So basically, I believe in what George Washington believed in, which was that we should have tariffs on products that make the cost of that product equal to the cost of making it in the United States. And the reason that's important is it prevents you from being dependent on a dictatorship like China and having 96% of your medicines coming from China and being subject to viruses and so forth in other forms and food and so forth moving into the country. So you're going to have to raise revenue for the government somehow, and you're better to do it on tariffs than you are on other taxes.
I want to get back to the pandemic for a moment, and by extension, America's healthcare system. We have seen racial disparities in the problems of care in our system for healthcare. How would you specifically approach these issues, these disparities, and how America receives healthcare?
Well, I think the disparities are, you know, they're not so much a result of race, although race is you know, perhaps you would argue a factor in poverty and in the living conditions. But I think it's not surprising that people of, you know, the white race or whatever might have lesser susceptibility to the virus because they're more socially distanced in many cases. They're not living in government housing or in, you know, small houses with multiple family members and so forth as much, so they don't have as much susceptibility to the virus. I think that essentially we need to look at things in terms of people's conditions rather than as to what race they're in. And I think you would find the numbers to be even more compelling that the poor have suffered more than the rich.
The Black Lives Matter movement, the protests you have seen all over the country after George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis. Black Americans are killed by police at more than twice the rate of white Americans. How would you address this issue as president?
Well, again, I think Black Americans in the communities that they live in have not been, if you will, as affluent and as law-abiding. So I do think that it's a natural result of it, you know, the shootings.
You can make that generalization.
Well, they're a symptom of the problems rather than the problems per se, because many times the cops do encounter very difficult situations in these communities, and it's improving the communities that will solve the problem to a great extent. But, you know, when you look at things like Breonna Taylor, is that her name, in Louisville, that is an example of not following the Constitution. I mean, that search and seizure is totally unreasonable. The Constitution says that there won't be unreasonable searches and seizures, and yet to break into someone's home in the middle of the night that has no criminal record and on the basis that an ex-boyfriend has dealt drugs is so nonsensical and such a violation of the Constitution that the cop himself is not as guilty of misbehavior as the system that allows him to get a warrant to break into someone's home like that. So a lot of the times we're looking at the symptom of nonsensical laws and nonsensical.
Yeah, but how would you tackle police brutality in America that is real?
Well, I think that you have to be very tough on police and cops if they misbehave. I mean, I can give you personal experiences. I was the other night, I couldn't figure out which way all this construction traffic was supposed to move, and I slowed down to try to figure out where I was going. And when the cop saw that I was hesitating to go a certain direction, he came up and it was very mouthy. I've had situations where I'd be pulled over and detained because some dog thought there was something in the car. I mean, I think we've all had encounters with police that are where they're rude and they're obnoxious and they're so forth. That needs to stop. But and when you look at the big picture of defunding police or that type of thing, you're getting too carried away to because you're not going to make things better. You're going to make things worse. So there are bad cops, and there are many of them that are very pompous and so forth because they have a badge on, but that doesn't mean you can defund the police department.
talking with former coal executive Don Blankenship, running for president under the Constitution Party. We're learning about his platform, his stances, taking your questions for a third party candidate at 800-642-1234. Don, there are millions of frontline workers who are putting their personal health on the line each day in this pandemic. They are leaning on their employers for personal protective equipment to keep them safe. How would you approach workplace safety standards as president?
Well, I'm very close to that situation because I have a daughter that works at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. So I'm aware of the uneasiness of family members who have, family on the front line, so to speak, of the coronavirus and other issues. But I think it was ridiculous that we, for example, didn't have, those equipment that we needed available to protect people, and they were wearing garbage cans or garbage bags to protect themselves instead of the right clothing in the early days of the virus. I think it's just another example of how inept the government is, that we're not more prepared for that type of situation, whether it be the mask or whatever. And simply put, we just got to be better prepared and do a better job of managing the government and listen more to the experts and the healthcare people themselves.
You went to prison for conspiring to violate federal mine safety standards. How would you approach labor issues as president?
Well, I actually went to prison because my politics were contrary to what the establishment's was. The government came in, changed the airflow, cut it in half on their own. I hadn't been at that mine in 12 years, and when it blew up, I did a documentary that explained what the government had actually done to cause the mine to blow up. So they charged me with a bunch of felonies and so forth. They couldn't convict me even 40 miles from the mine with a jury that
should executives be found criminally responsible for safety violations?
Yes and no. It depends on whether they are responsible for those safety violations. But
would you support the work of OSHA?
I support the work of OSHA and MSHA conceptually, but I can tell you that in the case of MSHA, which is the Mine Safety and Health Administration, the equivalent of OSHA in the mining industry, they are very political, and they try to pick winners and losers, and they're way behind technologically, and they don't train their people very well to do inspections, and they try to run the mines instead of regulate the mines. So it's not unlike, you're concerned about police brutality and the behavior of policemen. You have that same problem existing in a lot of these regulatory agencies, particularly in the Mine Safety and Health Administration.
Very quickly here, what would your approach be to the coal industry in America as president?
Well, I think, first of all, that we destroyed the coal industry in the United States under the guise or the misconception that we were going to lower the temperature of the earth. But the United States and China both were producing and using about 1 billion tons of coal in 1980, and China now produces and uses about 4 billion tons, up 3 billion tons. And we cut U.S. Production by 300 or 400 million. So we actually polluted the world with the policies that drove industries and coal use and so forth out of the United States, and drove the use of it to China to produce products that we then import. And the Chinese factories and the Chinese power plants have little or no environmental control compared to the United States. So,
Don, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's former coal executive Don Blankenship, running for president under the Constitution Party. This is the Ideas Network.